ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Today, when we hear stories about climate change, we often think about how temperatures have increased on our planet over the past 50 or 100 years. But if you're a geoscientist, your research could take you much farther back in Earth's history. Instead of studying the past 100, 200, or 300 years of data, you could be looking at what the world was like 200 or 300 million years ago. What lessons can we learn from that research? On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to try to answer that and many other questions about what our world once looked like and what it might become in the future. Our guests on this edition of UWM Today are John Isbell, a distinguished professor of geosciences at UWM. John is known internationally for his work. And accompanying John in the studio are two of his students, Kate Pauls and Nick Fedorchik. Both are working on their doctoral degrees under John's direction. Welcome, John, Kate, and Nick. Good to have you with us today. So we're going to go in the Wayback Machine on this program as we take a look at the history of the Earth itself. John, you've been studying this for many years.
Yes, definitely. My interests go back. It covers environmental change through time, not just with the late Paleozoic, although that's my primary interest, but looking at climate change really all the way back to the Precambrian and trying to understand what were the conditions that caused that change, how quickly did it change. When it comes to looking at the late Paleozoic, how big were the glaciers, what was the timing of glaciation, and ultimately what was the transition like from the late Paleozoic Ice Age into the late Paleozoic and Mesozoic greenhouse Earth.
So you're talking about a period literally hundreds of millions of years ago. What tools, what techniques do you use to be able to uncover what the Earth was like that far back?
We're sedimentary geologists, so our laboratory is really outside. It's looking at rock exposures and cliff faces along hillsides. It's also looking at rock cores. It's looking at samples that we collect, bringing back to the lab at UWM. Analyzing those samples, making thin sections, and trying to use that information and data to address some problems that we see in our interpretations of ancient landscapes and ancient climate change.
How do you date rocks or stones that far back?
Ultimately, you do a lot of relative dating, comparing it to one part of the stratigraphic column with another. But ultimately, you need fossils, either plants or animals, to be able to correlate it to areas where there is radiometric dating. So ultimately, you'll need to have some ash bed. The ash bed will contain zircons, and hopefully
what's it contains a zircon? Zircons.
Zircon is a very resistant mineral. It's a mineral that forms from a melt. And as it cools through certain temperatures, it will lock uranium and lead into the mineral, which then you can use to date the mineral.
So there are clues left behind because of the way in which the rocks are formed.
Yes, definitely. And Nick actually is working on detrital zircons. It's not dating the actual event, but it's dating the material that is being eroded and transported into the depositional basin.
Well, great opportunity to bring both Nick and Kate into the conversation. Nick, as John describes his work, really a lifetime of work, you're just beginning your journey into geosciences, relatively speaking. What attracted you into the study of this part of our world?
Well, like a lot of kids, I started by collecting rocks and fossils. But when I was in high school, actually, we had a family friend who worked at the Kentucky Geologic Survey, and he invited me to help him out doing basic data entry there. And that gave me a really good opportunity to get involved in some projects and to see more about what geosciences does. And, you know, I was hooked ever since then.
How old were you?
I was 16.
Okay. And so that began your journey, and now you're in a doctoral program here at UWM.
Yep. Yeah, I went to college in Ohio, and I met my master's advisor there. And he was also a graduate of the same undergraduate college as me. And it led me to UWM, and I met John, and I've continued ever since.
And Kate, how about your journey?
Well, I guess to echo Nick, I did collect rocks as a child, but I have a more circuitous route to getting to geology. I went into college, and I went to Augustana College in Illinois. I went in thinking I was going to be an English major, and I took a class. Augie has these classes. They're called liberal studies program or classes. And the first liberal studies class that I took was the geology of myths and legends, and I just kind of became hooked. I switched majors, and then I was also a Spanish major, and because of that, I was sort of directed towards John, whom I later found out was actually an alum of Augie. And so I came, just interviewed with John and then Dr. Margaret Fraser. They have sort of a project in Argentina, and I thought, what better way to kind of meld my two majors? And yeah, I just kind of stuck with it.
And you're studying in Milwaukee, but your research for both of you have taken you far beyond Milwaukee, hasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Nick, let's talk about the work that you're looking at, because it's thousands of miles from Milwaukee.
Yeah, so my dissertation research is in Brazil, the southernmost part of Brazil near the border with Uruguay. And it's really interesting, the time frame about 300 million years ago that I'm looking at, this area would have been connected to Namibia in Africa. And so a lot of what my project is trying to do is pin down where were these glaciers at this time, how large were they, where were they flowing from, and what was the climate like at that time.
And how about your research, Kate?
So for my master's, I started in Patagonia, Argentina, and was looking at a depositional basin in that part of the world. And for my dissertation, I just can't get enough of Argentina, so I'm still in Argentina, but more north of Argentina, kind of more similar in latitude to Nick's part of the world, but on the opposite side of Gondwana, or at least South American Gondwana.
Very neat. John, there's a reason why so much research is being done in that part of the world, and I think it may go back to Gondwana, right? Let's talk about Gondwana and what was happening with all of the continents of the world hundreds of millions of years ago.
Yeah, back about 300 million years ago, the Earth and all the continents were conglomerated into a single massive continent called Pangaea. The northern continents were called Laurasia, and the southern continents were called Gondwana. So that was composed of Antarctica, Africa, South America, India, and Australia. And at that time—
And they were just sitting down at the southern pole, southern part of the world.
Yeah, they were drifting around, and they were drifting over the South Pole. So much of the time that we're interested in, Antarctica was sitting over the South Pole, but gradually drifting off of the pole. And Patagonia, where Kate started her graduate career, was still in the polar circle as Antarctica. And Brazil was sitting more in the high mid-latitudes. But there was glaciation that was occurring across all of the southern continent. And our work is really trying to reconstruct the timing. Where were the glaciers? When were they waxing and waning? Were they doing it all at the same time? Were they doing it separately? And trying to figure out how it influenced other world systems, global systems.
Kate and Nick, as you take a look at the map of what the world looked like with all of the land, the continents massed together, when did you, as a student, when did you look at that and say, amazing, how could that be? Do you still wonder at this? It's just such an amazing part of our world's past.
I just think it's amazing the story of how scientists reconstructed this.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the evidence of rocks matching up in different continents, looking at the evidence of glaciers from different time periods matching up, fossil evidence. And then when you just look at the continents like Africa and South America,
yeah,
you can see that they fit together. And so this was a big story in geosciences.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Kate, it must give you pause as you think about the span of our lifetimes and we look at how our yeah. physical world has changed over these years.
Yeah, no, it's kind of crazy. I don't know. I like to tell people that I study rocks that are 300 million years old, and sometimes, you know, well, it depends on who I'm talking to. If I'm telling this to John, he's like, oh, okay, cool. But, you know, my family, they're like, whoa, that's amazing, because, you know, most of us don't live to, you know, that long. And so it's—
We're here for an instant.
Yes, basically. Yeah, yeah. And I was actually explaining, like, plate tectonics to my mother, because they just got back from Hawaii and, you know, the eruptions are pretty fascinating to them. And I was telling them how often or how fast most plates move, you know, on the order of centimeters a year. And my mom was just mind blown by that fact. Yeah, it was kind of funny.
John, the continents continue to move, right? I mean, we're looking at a snapshot of what the world may have been like hundreds of millions of years ago. But today, there still is movement.
Yeah, they're constantly in motion. And they come together, they split apart. They form supercontinents. They disperse like they are today, but ultimately they will come back together for a period of time and then disperse again as long as plate tectonics continues to be active on Earth.
So give us a 101 in plate tectonics. What's causing the motion or the movement of the ground that we're standing on?
It's heat distribution within the Earth. The interior of the Earth is at tremendous temperatures. And that dissipation, the movement of heat and molten rock in the mantle rising towards the surface creates tension and stresses on the lithosphere, which is the solid outer part of our planet. And ultimately, it causes them to break up. It has new crust forming, new material forming at mid-ocean ridges. That material is carried away from a mid-ocean ridge. As it cools, it becomes more dense. As it becomes more dense, it starts to sink back into the mantle. And ultimately, that process, the rifting at mid-ocean ridges, breaks continents apart. And ultimately, the destruction of ocean crust going back down into the mantle brings all the plates back together, and they collide and form new mountain ranges and leave old mountain ranges behind on continents as old scars of the plate tectonic history.
So as we take a look at our Rocky Mountains or Appalachians, there still is a lot more to change or to evolve in terms of the landscape of what we see as the United States.
Yeah, the landscape is ever changing. It's changing slowly, very slowly.
It won't look different tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning, it'll look a lot the same. But ultimately, it will change. There will be new collisions with other continents in the distant future, and new mountain ranges forming. And parts of the crust will subside and accumulate sediments and record what's going on with all of the plate tectonic activity.
Kate and Nick, you must be very humbling to be working with these concepts, with these theories that John has and his colleagues have proven, in fact, are true. I mean, you're now embarking on another generation of research. What do you hope to learn or discover that previous geoscientists haven't been able to figure out yet?
Yeah, I feel like we're just adding a small piece to the puzzle, and that's the best that we can hope to do right now. But, you know, we're looking at a very specific time slice in a very specific place, and that's our research. That's our whole dissertation research in a nutshell.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and today, on today's program, we're talking about geoscience and talking to sedimentologists who are involved in the study of what our Earth looked like hundreds of millions of years ago and perhaps a forecast of what it may look like well into the future. John, as you take a look at what the world was like in the distant, distant past, are there any clues of how our environment, the environment that we're living in today, is likely to evolve based on things like carbon? I know that carbon analysis is a big part of the study that you do.
Yeah. Well, the time frame that we are interested in as a group, the three of us, plus a number of other students that are also working primarily outside of the country and in Gondwana, we're looking at an ice age, which is the last complete record of initiation, duration, and termination of an ice age prior to the Cenozoic ice age, which we're currently in. And that ice age then, we often talk about it as being an analog to what we may be going through today. And there are a lot of similarities, but there's a lot of differences too. But it provides us this deep time view of what we can expect in terms of changing conditions, what is ultimately driving those changes. And as scientists, we argue back and forth, and we all have our pet ideas. But in the end, it's multiple things. CO2 in the atmosphere certainly drives large-scale climate change. It helped initiate the late Paleozoic ice age. There was a tremendous drawdown, in part because the continents were colliding. Mountain ranges were uplifting. It was exposing new rocks to weathering. Weathering will help remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. There was a lot of volcanic activity going on. The volcanic activity, especially if it's being erupted through coal seams, will pour tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere, and ultimately that'll change climate. But it's at a rate much slower than today. Orders of magnitude slower than what we're seeing today. But CO2 isn't the only thing. The drifting of continents, having continents at the pole, allows for the formation of glaciers. Uplift, mountain belts that are being uplifted will ultimately raise the land surface high enough where you'll get accumulation of snow that will persist from year to year. And if it lasts long enough, you'll produce a glacier. But when we're talking about ice ages, it's not a little glacier. It's of concern to us because that contains very little ice. It's ice sheets, and ice sheets are what really control and drive large-scale climate change in global systems.
And, of course, the concern today is that, well, we know the world is always changing, has always been changing and shifting. Today, because of what man is doing in terms of putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we're rapidly accelerating the rate at which the planet itself is evolving in terms of different temperatures, correct?
Yeah, definitely. If you start looking at where the heat source is coming from that drives climate, ultimately it's the sun. And a lot of changes in the amount of energy that the Earth gets is due to different orbital parameters. The Earth wobbles. It tilts back and forth a certain number of degrees. The orbit, the shape changes. And so all of those things will add or subtract energy. And if there is a glaciation, they will cause fluctuations in the ice mass. But ultimately, those fluctuations are going on all the time. And Earth is actually dominated by greenhouse conditions. And it's these little blips that last maybe 100 million years, like the late Paleozoic ice age, that are the anomalies. And the Cenozoic ice age is an anomaly, but it's the only conditions we know because that's the time frame when humans evolved. So we may owe our existence to the presence of that ice age.
We're living thanks to a blip.
Yeah. But we want to know what happens after that blip. Are we in the middle of the blip? Or are we coming to the end of that blip? And the rate at which we're pouring CO2 into the atmosphere, we haven't seen CO2 in the atmosphere at that levels in minor blips in maybe 3 to 5 million years, but probably 16 million years. And that's prior to us coming onto the planet. So we're moving into an unknown type of setting in terms of what we're doing to the atmosphere.
Nick and Kate, as you hear John describe the analysis of our changing world, where do you see your research going? Nick, you specifically, do you see yourself someday following in the shoes of people like John as a scientist, as a professor. There are a lot of other industries that use people who have geoscience knowledge that you're gaining today.
Yeah, I personally am interested in continuing to do research, and I enjoy teaching as well. And this topic of glacial sedimentation is really an interest of mine.
Yeah. How about you, Kay?
Oh, yeah. That's part of the reason why I decided to get my PhD. I really wanted to teach and continue to educate and do research on, you know, undergraduate, graduate levels with the future generations or the future geologists.
Well, you are teaching students now.
Yeah.
Along the way. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got undergrad students in your classes. What do they think about the work that you're doing? Do you ever have conversations with them about the travels that you've done and the aspirations you have to spend a lifetime studying rocks?
It's really fulfilling when you meet students who are interested in the geosciences and you convince them to go into geology. And I think one of the big allures of what we do is travel. We get to travel all over the place and go to interesting places, have colleagues, international colleagues, and study these glacial rocks all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to use any kind of photos that I take out in the field and bring them back and put them in my lectures for my labs. And, yeah, just really, I don't know, show them, like, how cool it is to be in the field and how you can actually see the things that we're actually teaching them and start to make sense of the world.
When you are in the field and you come across something nobody else has seen before, you chip away and you see a rock that is hundreds of millions of years old, how do you feel when you know that nobody else has seen that before you?
It's exciting. And oftentimes, you know, we get excited in the field over something that most people would look at and be like, what is this?
Yeah. No, it's...
Or you jump up and down or you yell or what?
I guess it depends on what it is, you know. I know a particular rippled pavement in Patagonia. I waited 2 years to see it and it was just as spectacular because John had found it 2012, and then I was able to go back in 2014, and he taunted me with all these photos of it, you know, that he took, and I wasn't able to go with him to that particular location that day, and yeah, I might have done a little dance when I got to finally see it.
Just a little dance.
John, it's got to be exciting for you as a professor to see your proteges, to see young people developing the knowledge and the interest, the desire to do the same sort of work that you've been doing for decades.
Yeah. I look at it, one, their energy keeps me young and it keeps me excited. And it's really fun to see the light bulb go off in their eyes. But they bring ideas that I can't or don't bring. And they constantly are putting that new energy into our research. And I don't look at the two of these students and the other four or five that I advise as students. I look at them as collaborators, and together we're tackling that problem. So they may be students, but both of them and the other students that I have already published in international journals, and they're rapidly becoming experts in the field. And so, you know, I may be helping them out now, but I'm going to ride on their coattails because these guys are really good, strong scientists. I don't look at them as students. They are definitely collaborators.
Well, Kate and Nick both said that their goal is to follow in your footsteps, to become academics, to teach and to continue the research. But there are other professions that people who study geosciences can pursue. What are those?
A lot of sedimentary geologists do end up looking at some aspect of the petroleum field, trying to find oil and gas and mineral resources and mining. Banking, though, also employs geologists. If you are working for a bank that's going to float $100 million or $200 million loan to an oil company, they need to have people that can assess what they're doing. So they hire geologists as well. So It's really varied. It could be environmental fields, trying to find groundwater, looking at contaminant flow within the ground and within lakes and rivers and so forth. So it's really open to your imagination. And some of the fields that we have today that students go into, you know, there are going to be new fields opening up. And some of the things the students that we have at UWM will be developing those fields.
It's pretty really neat knowing that UWM has such a great strength in this area.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I'm really fortunate to have be associated with people like the two of these. And I've got other students, Libby Ives and Natalie McNall and Mark Barecki and Jenny Albrecht and Scott Litwin. All of them are brilliant young people that are bringing their energy into the field and their expertise as it develops. So it's exciting. I hope to be around to see what all they do in the future.
Nick and Kate, you've got to be thrilled having somebody like John as your guide, your mentor.
Yeah, we get to spend months in the field with yeah. John, so he's a great mentor, and you know, it's that experience of seeing the rocks with him in the field and learning from him is invaluable.
Yeah, yeah, no, and I mean, we meet some really amazing people, you know, outside of the country, really, and it's I think I have met so many Argentines that I absolutely, you know, love and love to stay in touch with, and that would not be possible without John and, you know, the opportunities that he provides all of his students.
The beauty of having great professors and great students come together and create something even better, right?
I keep a running total. my award to them is who I've been out of the country the most with, and these two are fighting to see who has been out of the country the most with me. Kate's currently leading at 8.
Yeah.
But Nick's right behind, and he'll probably tire this summer.
Mm-hmm. Well, we wish you happy trails, happy travels, and happy career. It sounds like you're both headed in the right direction. Thanks so much, all, for being our guest on this edition of UWM Today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Isbell, Distinguished Professor of Geosciences, and two of his PhD students, Kate Pauls and Nick Fedorchuk, our guest today, as we learn about geoscience and a time in the way, way back machine that certainly fascinates me, and I suspect is entertaining and fascinating to many of you, our listeners. That's all for this week's program. We will see you next week at the same time. And remember, if you'd ever like to listen to this program again or listen to any of the other amazing interviews we've done with students and faculty and staff at UWM, just go to the WUWM.com website. It's WUWM.com/UWM Today, and you'll see podcasts that you can listen to from today into the Wayback Machine. We have a lot of them up there. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.